Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We are joined by our friend Andrea Picciotti-Bear of EWTN News, legal analyst, to talk about last week's Supreme Court decision pertaining to the St. Isidore of Seville Virtual School. Now, last week, the Supreme Court deadlocked in its case considering St. Isidore of Seville School in Oklahoma. And this is a result that allows State Attorney General Gettner Drummond from certifying the Catholic Charter School. It's been an ongoing saga. Now, for the backdrop, for some of you who don't remember or are just recently joining us, in June of 2023, Oklahoma Statewide Virtual Charter School Board approved the establishment of St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School as a charter school, and it was aimed to provide K-12 Catholic education online. And eventually, that approval was removed. In June of 2024, the Oklahoma Supreme Court ruled in a 6-2 decision that the contract that established St. Isidore violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And that's how the case has been pushed from state Supreme Court to now federal Supreme Court. And I give you this background because when we get Andrea on later, we want to talk about the details of this recent decision, what we can learn from it, what steps moving forward will be, because this is a landmark case. This is the first time, if you will, that St. Isidore of Seville, for example, it's the first time that a Catholic virtual school was pushing to become the first publicly funded religious charter school. And so this would be a precedent-setting case. We move on from there to speak with Christopher Kayser about remembering the recently deceased Alasdair MacIntyre. He is a renowned Catholic philosopher. He died last week at the age of 96, a major contributor to 20th century moral and political philosophy. He's best known for his 1981 book, After Virtue. I've quoted from this book quite a bit in the past. It's a seminal work, to say the least. And then finally, we're going to end this hour by talking about the reality of public universities, how far they've fallen, and how I believe a reclamation of the Catholic ethos of academia is what's going to redeem and renew the direction of higher education in the U.S. and in the world. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, May 28th. It's the Feast of Blessed Stefan Wyszynski. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. Foreign officials who censor Americans will have their U.S. visas banned. Secretary of State Marco Rubio saying foreign officials have taken flagrant censorship actions against U.S. tech companies and U.S. citizens that reach beyond their authority and into the U.S. Elusive Gaza chief Mohammed Sinwar is dead. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu included Sinwar's name in a list of Hamas leaders killed in strikes while speaking to Parliament. Sinwar was one of Israel's most wanted men. He was a younger brother of the militant group's former leader, who was killed last year. Savannah Crisley says she still doesn't believe that it's real after President Trump said he will pardon her parents. Todd and Julie Crisley starred in the Crisley Knows Best reality series that lasted from 2014 until 2023, and they were convicted of bank fraud and tax evasion charges in 2022. According to Savannah, the president said her parents were treated unfairly from everyone that he has spoken to. The U.S. and Argentina are launching what they call an alternative international health system. It comes after both nations have moved to withdraw from the World Health Organization. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. issuing a joint statement with Argentina's Minister of Health discussing their respective nations' decisions to withdraw from the Global Health Authority. President Trump had started the process of withdrawing during his first term, but former President Biden reversed that move before it took effect. And the Justice Department is looking into California state law that lets transgender athletes compete in girls' high school sports and whether it violates federal civil rights laws. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Pita. Andrea Picciotti-Bear, legal analyst for EWTN News, director of the Conscience Project, no stranger to this program, and she joins us this week to talk about how the Supreme Court deadlocked in its case considering St. Isidore of Seville virtual school in Oklahoma. This result allows State Attorney General Gentner Drummond from certifying the Catholic Charter School. So let's discuss this decision and steps forward. Andrea, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing great, Marcus. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure. And I read this decision with, I guess, a small level of surprise, but I want to hear your insights on this.
Yeah, no, I think surprise and disappointment are the great ways to describe a very brief decision, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a one-liner opinion, simply stating that the judgment of the Oklahoma Supreme Court was affirmed by, quote, an equally divided court. Which you don't have to be an expert at mental math to know. How does that work out? There are 9 justices. How do you be equally divided? And it's because one of the justices recused herself. So mm-hmm. Justice Amy Coney Barrett mm-hmm. recused herself from consideration of the case, and that meant that there were 4 justices on one side and 4 on the other. What's interesting is they didn't there were no concurrences, no dissents, right. No who lined up on what side. So we're really only in the realm of speculation as to who aligned on one side of the case or the other. But really what's interesting, Marcus, is because this is a deadlock and because the precedent is really the Oklahoma Supreme Court, there isn't Supreme Court precedent that would govern future cases.
Yeah.
So it's almost kind of like a non-decision decision.
Right.
And I think it just means, you know, game on when it comes to continuing to insist in religious freedom protections and school choice initiatives.
And we have to be very honest about seeing the novelty, if you will, of this case. And that's why it's such an important one, that this would be the first national school, national publicly funded religious charter school. And so questions about the constitutional support for First Amendment rights here should come into play. And that's why this non-decision, like I mentioned, comes across as a bit of a surprise. It was abrupt. It doesn't seem to be very well reasoned out. And we are not given a lot of reasons as to why this is.
Yeah, no, we really aren't given any reasons other than that they were deadlocked, right? I do think you're right that this case does trigger the 2 religion clauses of the First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause mm-hmm. and the Establishment Clause. And as we've discussed every time we get together, it seems like, Marcus, these aren't competing clauses,
yep.
but instead clauses that work together to protect religious freedom. The Attorney General for Oklahoma thought, hey, giving public money to a religious charter school would violate the Establishment Clause. And I think that the school and the charter school board said, no, you know, a charter school is a privately created, privately administered mm-hmm. entity with very little government regulation or oversight. It's publicly funded, but it's like a government contractor.
Right.
A government contractor isn't the government. It's a contractor. So, you know, mindful of that difference, we're not dealing with a state actor as if a public school were to teach, Catholic teaching as truth, instead of, you know, Catholic teaching as a course of study.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were to teach it, that would cause Establishment Clause problems. This one doesn't.
Yep.
What it does do, though, by excluding the Catholic school from eligibility because of religion, it interferes with the Free Exercise Clause. And that's kind of grounded in really recent decisions in school choice cases themselves, where Religious schools were excluded from a voucher program in Maine or a scholarship program in Montana, and the Supreme Court in both cases said that kind of exclusion was discrimination based on religion and was odious to the Constitution.
Yeah.
So I think had we had a full court, we would have seen a 5-4 or maybe even a 6-3 decision.
And we know the names of the justices that were for the certification of St. Isidore. So you've got Justice Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. And it would appear that this is just commentary at this point because we don't hear statements from them, but it would appear that there's a kind of appreciation that the exclusion of a school like St. Isidore's from charter school programs by itself becomes an act of religious discrimination. And like you've been mentioning, too, we just haven't heard a lot as a result of hearing this case.
Yeah, no, and part of that, I mean, those statements were really clear and apparent, the positions of those four justices during oral argument back in April.
Mm-hmm.
What I think people are speculating is that Chief Justice John Roberts was on the other side. And some of it that he was wrestling with during oral argument, and he was kind of balanced in his questions to both parties, were the issue of state action. Is St. Isidore's looking more like a government actor than a typical government contractor,
mm-hmm.
Enough to say that it was, you know, engaged in state action. And I really just think it's because for far too long, our public schools have a monopoly over our education system. You know, back in the day before the system of public education, there were much more private school presence and public money going to private schools as well. So even some of those were federal money going to teach on Indians, you know, for Native Americans by Catholic nuns. It's not that our history has not allowed for public funding of religious institutions, but we've definitely in more recent years gotten to this kind of secularization of education and what I believe is a misunderstanding of the Establishment Clause in general.
Yep. And by virtue of that, the secularization of education has become a kind of quasi-religious practice because it demands no tolerance for, in this case, religious institutions, and therefore that position is by itself discriminatory.
No, I agree completely. And I think when we pull back and think about education as kind of like a feast of offerings for young learners.
Mm-hmm.
Public schools are a great option for many families, but so are private independent schools, private religious schools, and school choice is really bringing us back to parents as primary educators, finding the right fit and being able to take the resources that our taxes are offering to be able to make that right fit affordable. I like the charter school idea, and we can see, I think there are like 45 states plus the District of Columbia that have charter programs. What is difficult, and we see it, they are doing a fantastic job, as are our Catholic schools doing a fantastic job. Why not the kind of wonderful combination of the two, a Catholic charter school? I think it's going to raise all boats. Especially for kids in schools that are underperforming.
Yep. And we have to be very honest that, especially in recent years since COVID, we have seen a great underperformance, especially on the part of the public schooling system. And so looking at Justice Roberts' comments that a state need not subsidize private education, but once it decides to do so, it cannot disqualify solely because they are religious. I mean, this is commonsensical argumentation, and that's why there's going to have to be a lot more push on the part of St. Isidore's.
Yeah, no, and whether it's St. Isidore's or other states, mm-hmm. other Catholic schools that are applying for charter school status, I really think if you're thinking of partnering with your local diocese or starting an independent Christian Catholic school, get out there and apply for charter school status. The statement that you made from Roberts was in a couple of prior cases.
Yep.
That is the precedent that our courts should be looking to. And that really will allow these schools to flourish.
Yep. Always a joy, Andrea. Thank you so much for covering this and having these conversations with us.
Oh, thanks, Marcus, for having me on. Have a good evening.
You too. My guest, Andrea Picciotti-Bear, legal analyst for EWT and News, director of the Conscience Project, and we've been talking about the disappointing decision that we've seen the Supreme Court take pertaining to the St. Isidore of Seville case. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
This summer, take a vacation that lifts your spirit and soul. Join Corporate Travel for the annual Grand Getaway on beautiful Mackinac Island, August 3rd to the 5th. Experience historic Grand Hotel, powerful talks from Father Mike Schmidt, Steve Ray, Dr. Edward Sri, and Father Leo Padalinghug, plus live broadcasts with Teresa Tamio, daily mass, four-course dinners, and dancing. Faith, fellowship, and fun in one retreat. Only a few rooms remaining. Don't miss out.
Book this Ave Maria Radio trip now by checking the travel page on avemariaradio.net.
Hi, Vanessa Denha-Garmo here, inviting you to tune into Epiphany. We're made to praise God and celebrate our faith. I want to encourage listeners to connect, communicate, and collaborate with the faith community. Life is a journey, and along the way, we have those Epiphany moments that bring us closer to Christ. Please partner with me and celebrate the diversity of our Catholic Church.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon, only on Ave Maria Radio.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The renowned Catholic philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre passed away last week at the age of 96. He was a major contributor to 20th century moral and political philosophy. He's best known for his 1981 book, After Virtue. We discuss his life and influence with Christopher Kayser. Christopher is the Honorary Professor of Renewal of Catholic Intellectual Life at the Word on Fire Institute and Professor of Philosophy at Loyola Marymount University. Chris, it's great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Well, I want to say thank you for this piece about MacIntyre. I think it's a good tribute piece, but you're also balanced about talking about his legacy and the work that he has done well. And I'd like to begin with After Virtue. It's a book that I myself have quoted quite a number of times in the past, whether in talks or in articles. And it's hilarious when it came out, like you note, Newsweek called it a stunning new study of ethics. And in my mind, reading it, it was really just a reclamation of the foundational classical principle of virtue ethics represented. So I'd like to begin there.
Yeah, I think you're right. What Alasdair was doing was a recovery and a renewal of a very, very long tradition of ethics going back to Aristotle and the Stoics and running through the whole Christian tradition. So you have church fathers like Ambrose and Augustine making use of virtue ethics. And then, of course, Thomas Aquinas in his Summa Theologiae dedicates the whole Secunda Secundae to talking about the virtues, the infused theological virtues of faith, hope, and love, and also the cardinal virtues.
Yeah.
So this tradition that MacIntyre is attempting to revive is a very ancient one, and one that was never lost in the Catholic tradition. I mean, you can look at Catholic moral theologians writing in the 20th century, and we still maintained this emphasis on the importance of the virtues. But what MacIntyre did is really bring it to a new audience, a contemporary audience of secular philosophers.
Right. And that's precisely why when we consider his work, we also have to consider the historical milieu within which he was doing the work. And we realize that the philosophical conversations of the academies had largely shifted outside of the Catholic intellectual enterprise. Like you rightly note and mention, Kantian duty ethics, utilitarian consequentialists, proportionalists, these were the schools of thought of the day as it pertained to human function in the societal sphere. So I guess it's no wonder one would think, after virtue was tremendously novel, he was hammering with he was using a scalpel, really, to reintroduce the classical system of human flourishing.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And McIntyre's view was basically that, as he put it, the Enlightenment project had to fail.
Mm-hmm.
So what you had in the Enlightenment was an attempt to reground basic ethical truths like you shall not murder, shall not steal, shall not commit adultery, either on the basis of a kind of individualism as advocated by Kant, or on the basis of a utilitarian calculus as advocated by John Stuart Mill.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what McIntyre said is that both of these alternatives were bound to fail. And that's exactly what you saw in academic philosophy, where people couldn't come to an agreement about the justification of these norms, even though people did recognize that we need these norms for communities to survive.
And that's why, Chris, when you look at his sequels, for example, Whose Justice, which Rationality, he's blunt about this. He goes, there's no practical rationality without the virtues of character. And he was right. The quote-unquote Enlightenment, right, this radicalized rationalism that we saw take over the global sphere, it untethered itself from tradition, if I borrow McIntyre's language, and all it did was it wound up becoming circular. It destroyed the very premise on which it aimed to build itself.
Right, and the Enlightenment project in more recent decades has come under severe critique from postmodern critiques.
Mm-hmm.
So the Enlightenment emphasis on reason alone as the sole guide that we need to move us forward. Basically, the postmodernists said, well, look, reason is really rationalization. When people say they're reasoning and arguing, really what they're doing is just exposing their prejudices and biases. And so McIntyre said, well, at the end of the day, we need to choose either between a kind of nihilistic Nietzschean postmodernism on the one hand, or a return to a Thomistic Aristotelian view on the other hand.
Right.
And McIntyre obviously put his cards and his weight behind the Thomistic Aristotelian view and rejection of a kind of postmodern Nietzschean view.
I have to ask, how much of his philosophical sanity do you think is owed to the fact that he didn't pursue a PhD?
Well, I don't know if I'd agree with Alistair that a PhD necessarily makes someone uneducated, but I do get his point that what can happen with a PhD is that you gain a very deep and extensive knowledge of one very narrow sliver of reality. And what that can do is kind of make you unable to appreciate and to see the bigger picture. And that was really what Alistair excelled at, kind of giving us the big picture, the broad historical sweep of history and how things are connected. That was really what he excelled at doing.
And exactly, and therein lies a lot of the issue with philosophical conversations in academies outside of the Catholic intellectual tradition, that you've got these very niche experts of very particular narrow areas of philosophy, all trying to attempt to synthesize and come up with a newfound ethics system. And like you've mentioned, all we wound up doing is turning back and critiquing this Enlightenment experiment because it has become the author of its own failure.
Yeah, I think part of McIntyre's effort is to really return us to a sense of the history of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So before After Virtue, he wrote a book called A Short History of Ethics. And he begins basically, pre-Homeric thought and goes all the way through into the 20th century to give us a kind of historical span, because he was convinced that if we try to gain wisdom in a totally ahistorical way, kind of cook it up for ourselves in our hot room alone, that we're bound not to make much progress. And part of the way we can make progress is by understanding what can and has been thought before,
mm-hmm.
so that we understand the possibilities that exist for us now. And for McIntyre, the lodestar, as it were, the the pinnacle of achievement in all this was for him, St. Thomas Aquinas, who really developed a huge synthesis
right.
of everything that was known before him and brought that to not just a kind of a synthesis, but also to a real clarity
mm-hmm.
in expression. So for McIntyre, I guess after virtue really points eventually directly, rather, towards St. Thomas Aquinas.
Right. And in fact, one could make the argument, in no way am I trying to elevate him to Aquinas' stature, but one could make the argument that he studied Aquinas not just for the sake of learning from him, but for the mastery of a method of synthesis, because it's very clear that McIntyre didn't want to espouse any one school, though he found himself being, by his own admission, a Thomistic Aristotelian.
That's right. Yeah, he described himself as a Thomistic Aristotelian, and he came to that conclusion when he was about 55 years old as a result of trying to convince his students that Thomism was mistaken. So he came to it, you know, rather late in life, but I think that his prior training really aided him in what he did later, because he had this prior training in more mainstream philosophy, mainstream analytic philosophy. But he was, you might say, a maverick
mm-hmm.
in that he called into question fundamentally the presuppositions and the fundamental orientation of contemporary moral philosophy.
And that's why when you take a look at the works of anywhere from his contemporaries to his ilk, you can stand him up with names like Anscombe and Dummett, and you realize that these were people who were reattempting that great synthesis of rationalistic inquiry, or rational inquiry, I should say, in light of the gift of divine revelation, and he saw no contradiction between the two.
Yeah, that's a very important point. McIntyre would reject a kind of choice, either faith or reason. Rather, he advocated a reasonable faith and a faithful reason.
Yeah. My guest is Dr. Christopher Kaiser. He is the honorary professor for the renewal of Catholic intellectual life at the Word on Fire Institute, and we are talking about the legacy and heritage of Alistair McIntyre. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jingle.
In the seventh rule of St. Ignatius of Loyola's 14 Rules for the Discernment of Spirits, St. Ignatius writes, "So that he may resist the various agitations and temptations of the enemy, what will happen to the individual who over time begins to habitually become more aware of their interior spiritual experience, identifies the difference between spiritual consolation and spiritual desolation, and begins to take active steps towards rejecting spiritual desolation. New spiritual strength begins to grow, and virtue develops within us. Resisting desolation leads to resisting desolation when it returns, and in resisting it, protects us from the harm the desolation wants to bring upon us. Father Timothy Gallagher writes, "When spiritual consolation is embraced and spiritual desolation resisted, each movement permits its own kind of growth."
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Spring into mowing season with a new Cub Cadet lawn tractor from Weingarts. We've been helping families like yours choose the right power equipment since 1945. Cub Cadet XT Enduro Series tractors are engineered to offer the best combination of quality, value, and performance. Cub Cadet lawn and garden tractors offer comfort and year-round versatility. Stop by our stores to help find your next Cub Cadet or visit us online at Weingarts.com. From our family to yours, thank you for letting us serve you.
Weingarts, Weingarts, everything.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm speaking with Dr. Christopher Kayser, Honorary Professor for the Renewal of Catholic Intellectual Life at the Word on Fire Institute. Chris, we were talking earlier, we had just left off beginning to touch on McIntyre's stalwart commitment to the rapprochement of faith and reason that he found come to a full flourishing in the Catholic faith. Now, it took him a while to get there. He even admitted to being a kind of atheist for a while. But when he did finally get there, he saw that the two were inseparable realities to the Christian revelation.
That's right. That's right. So faith and reason find an ultimate harmony in God himself. So God is wise, and God is intelligent, and so God is also the author of the book of nature. And God also gives us the book of Revelation. God reveals himself in Jesus, most of all, but also reveals himself through a whole series of prophets in the Old Testament, and reveals himself also in the church. So we have God who's not contradictory, God who's reasonable. And so yeah, McIntyre really saw faith and reason as harmonious. I think he would endorse the idea that John Paul II had in Fides et Ratio, that faith and reason are like two wings that allow the human person to fly up towards a greater understanding of the truth.
And that's why when you look at how far he came, you can also appreciate the tremendous amount of epistemological labor that brought him there. And so he looks back then at the Enlightenment, and he realizes what a doomed enterprise it was from the outset. Detaching reason from a traditional grounding means you can't define reason qua reason anymore.
That's right, yeah. So in After Virtue, he has a famous chapter called Why the Enlightenment Project Had to Fail. Mm-hmm. And so he was not surprised by developments, postmodern developments that called reason into question. So later thinkers that followed on Nietzsche like Foucault, I think McIntyre saw as a natural outgrowth of the Enlightenment, where it would be a little bit like, to use an analogy, you know, you cut a flower out of your garden and put it in a vase. Well, you know, it'll look healthy for a little bit, but then once it's separated from its roots, the flower eventually wilts. And so too, reason detached from its ultimate orientation to the transcendent ends up withering and ends up even dying.
And that's why I don't favor the term enlightenment, and as I probably suspect neither do you. But that's why this rationalistic revolt led to a tremendous amount of moral fragmentation and a startling proliferation of emotivism in the public sphere. And McIntyre, he put his finger on the pulse when he called that out. So tell us about why that is.
Well, he basically thought of emotivism. By emotivism, what he meant is a moral theory going back to a British philosopher named Stevenson, where moral claims are translated, as it were, into just emotive claims. So right. If I say murder is wrong, really what I'm saying is boo murder, or, you know, and I'm not really making a claim about reality or about facts. It's just a statement of my own emotions. And if I say, you know, helping poor people is good, I'm really just saying hooray, or gives me warm fuzzies inside. But when we think about moral language as simply the expression of emotions, you know, we end up getting in a situation where an absolute relativism is the order of the day, because, you know, my emotions are really detached from any objective or true statement about the world. I can have, you know, my emotions influenced greatly by, you know, how I slept last night, and
right,
whether
right.
indigestion and all kinds of things. So at the end of the day, if moral claims are really just matters of expressions of emotion, then we really have no moral basis at all for condemning racism or condemning any other action.
And in fact, if I may expand that just a tad, in After Virtue, he also addresses how truth claims become impossible as a result. And that's why today, even answering a basic question such as what is a woman, it's become laughable how popular the phrase has become. But it highlights a reality detached from its roots of tradition that inform objective reason and therefore morality. Reason ceases to be true reason.
That's right. And I think McIntyre is also calling attention to the fact that really everyone operates out of a tradition. So that even the people who claim to reject tradition, in fact, there's a tradition of rejecting tradition. So that too goes back many centuries.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we could have a inquiry that's tradition free, that we just
right.
start off with our own ideas, is really an impossibility, in part because whenever we're expressing ourselves in language, our language is always something that we inherit, right? We learn our language from our parents and from, you know, teachers, et cetera. We don't just make up our language on our own. And
mm-hmm.
our language is going to obviously influence how we think about things. And so, yeah, McIntyre wanted us to be more self-conscious about the reality that everyone is, in fact, working out of a tradition, even if the person may consider themselves tradition-free or even against tradition.
Right. And again, McIntyre is not unique, like you've mentioned, in highlighting even this reality of language and what it can objectively convey. He's drawing from an Aristotelian and eventually Thomistic tradition that's drawing, again, from a tradition far richer than itself. And it's important that we understand that the utilization of language as an instrument allows us to convey these truths so that we can live truly good lives, and to detach one from the other, detach all from each other, means that you will result in a fragmented societal existence.
Yes, and McIntyre was very concerned about that fragmentation that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that he changed his mind about was the so-called unity of the virtues.
Uh-huh.
So McIntyre came to believe that the virtues really hung together. So you could make an analogy a little bit like the organs of your body. If you've got a bad heart, well, that just does affect all the organs of your body.
Right.
Or if your lungs aren't working right, it just does affect all the other organs of your body. So to be a real healthy person, you really need all the organs of your body to work together and to be healthy. And to a degree, the same thing's true of a society. To the degree that our society has individuals that
right.
are really not flourishing, this is going to that very degree, undermine the well-being of the whole.
Right. And again, you know, you're seeing these illusions borrowed from minds greater than himself, which again shows his great capacity at synthesis, because Chesterton talks about this in Orthodoxy, about how the world is full today of the virtues gone mad because they stand in isolation from one another. And so this integrated reality finds virtue ethics culminating in a transcendent worldview of the source of all virtue, the source of all good itself, namely God.
That's correct. And McIntyre would say that what makes something a virtue is that we can move from what human beings are as they are right now to what they potentially could be. And the bridge between those is the virtues. The virtues are those habits
mm-hmm.
that allow us to develop towards our final end, towards our ultimate happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And like Aquinas, the ultimate happiness is ultimately to have perfect love, perfect truth, and perfect goodness. In other words, to have a perfect relationship with a perfect God.
And in Off to Virtue, he calls this the narrative quest or the story to which we belong. And I see the allusions to this grander narrative of the biblical reality, salvation history, and that's what grounds the virtues rightly.
Yeah, so McIntyre kind of shifted over time. So he had a kind of non-metaphysical view in After Virtue, and then later he rejected his earlier view and adopted a more metaphysically rich kind of view. And so his later view is actually more compatible with the Catholicism that he adopted, because when he wrote After Virtue, he was not yet Catholic. He became Catholic after he wrote that book, After Virtue. So when he became Catholic, I think part of that was really embracing a kind of worldview that includes the story of salvation, the story of God's relationship to God's people, which begins in the Old Testament, but really continues to today in the church.
Yeah. And to be very honest, I think anyone reading Off to Virtue when it was published saw that inevitably he was going to wind up Catholic. But thank you so much, Chris, for making the time. Greatly enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, too.
My guest, Dr. Christopher Kayser, Honorary Professor for the Renewal of Catholic Intellectual Life at the Word on Fire Institute. We've been talking about the contribution and legacy of Alasdair MacIntyre, who passed away last week. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When I heard other business owners say they finally found someone in the credit card industry they can trust, I wondered how he could help me. So when Mark from Schisler CPC offered to show me where all the money goes for credit card processing with a free analysis of my business, I jumped on it. He reviewed how the industry works, where we could save, and offered a no-contract guarantee on savings and excellent customer service. I'm saving thousands of dollars a year. Schisler CPC. Trust in them.
More information available on the Ave Maria website under Sponsor Business Directory.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them. So you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
Welcome to an Advanced Dentistry Center family. This is Dr. Metti, and our team strives to treat you like family in a loving and compassionate way as we focus on serving you in a Christ-like manner. We do this by emphasizing prevention and general well-being for a lifetime. Our private practice is small, personal, state-of-the-art, and innovative, with the goal to educate and motivate our patients in improving their oral health. It is through a partnership with you that you will achieve the goals for your smile. Advanced Dentistry is serious about the level of care we provide, with attention to details and an exceptional level of care, skill, and judgment. We are thrilled for the opportunity to serve you.
Dr. Matthew and the team invite you to visit them at AdvancedDentistryCenter.com or call them at 248-594-9592. That's 248-594-9592. AdvancedDentistryCenter.com.
The Catholic Catechism tells us that an evil end can corrupt an objectively good act. Our Lord pointed this out when he spoke of Pharisees praying and fasting, both objectively good acts, in order to be seen by men, a morally corrupt end which therefore corrupts all the actions. On the other hand, a good intention cannot justify an objectively evil action. One cannot turn fornication, a morally evil action in and of itself, by participating in it, even to save a life. Fornication is always wrong because it involves a disorder of the will, a moral evil. It is an error, the Catholic Catechism tells us, therefore, to judge an act merely by considering the intention that inspired it or the circumstances such as social pressure or emergency. The end never justifies the means. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. George Weigel put out a piece in the National Catholic Register about universities in general and Catholic universities in specificity. He sparked some thoughts that I'd like to share with you pertaining to the sheer decline of public education. Our very social concept of truth is under siege. The university, once the church's cathedral of the intellect, has become a temple to relativism, technocracy, and soulless pragmatism. The modern university no longer forms souls, it programs consumers. Once the glory of Christendom, our institutions of higher learning now echo with the nihilistic whispers of postmodern despair. It's time to recall the true origins of the university, its ecclesial vocation, and the only worldview capable of restoring it to grace, the Catholic covenantal framework. The university is not a secular invention. I don't care who tries to rewrite history. It is a gift from the Catholic Church to the world. It's a fruit of the Church's unique commitment to the harmonious unity of faith and reason. In the 12th and 13th centuries, the Church founded the first university. So you've got Paris, Bologna, Oxford, Salamanca. And these were not as factories for job readiness, they were sanctuaries of truth. Their mission? To behold the order of creation and lift the mind toward the Creator. These institutions grew out of the cathedral schools, deeply embedded in the Church's liturgical life, under the aegis of bishops and popes, who saw learning as a path to contemplating God. St. John Henry Newman, in his seminal work, The Idea of a University, articulates this vision with crystal clarity. He says, "A university is, according to the usual designation, an alma mater, knowing her children one by one, not a foundry or a mint or a treadmill." Newman insists the university must form the whole person, mind, soul, and character, not merely transmit information. It must integrate all disciplines under the highest science, theology, the queen of the sciences, the only discipline capable of ordering all others to their ultimate purpose. So this was not an accident of medieval enthusiasm, it was deliberate. The very concept of a university, quite frankly, universitas, denotes a unity of knowledge. Theology was the integrating core, because it alone asked the ultimate questions. Who are we? Why do we exist? What is our end? The founding of the university was covenantal in nature. It was a spiritual act by the Bride of Christ to educate her children into the Logos, the divine word, through whom all things were made. Education at its root is a participation in this covenant between God and man, a formative journey into the truth that sets us free. With the Enlightenment, quote-unquote, came a revolt. Descartes, Voltaire, Hume, and their heirs, all of them claimed that reason could be its own God, elevated and exalted from God who is the true Logos. So they exalted human autonomy and rejected the metaphysical order that grounds our reason in God, in the Logos. Education was no longer about conforming the mind to the reality God has made, but manipulating reality to suit man's will. This revolt fragmented knowledge. Philosophy severed from theology, the sciences became skeptical of metaphysics and theology, but also each other. Literature and the arts were stripped of sacramental meaning, and the result was what Pope Benedict XVI decried in his 2006 Regensburg address. The West has long been endangered by this aversion to the questions which underlie human rationality and can only suffer great harm thereby. Benedict warned us, reducing reason to mere empiricism and calculation, we have amputated the soul of education. What remains is a university that excels in data, but falters in wisdom. It celebrates diversity of thought and demographic, but recoils from truth itself. This is the dictatorship of relativism he warned us about, and unfortunately it's reigning supreme down the road in our universities. What this rationalistic turn accomplished was the disintegration of the university's covenantal identity. Without a unifying vision of the human person, the university became a dismembered body. Faculties no longer speaking to each other, disciplines at odds, professors without a shared telos end, and students with no idea why any of it matters beyond grades and eventually a paycheck. When universities cast out the divine and the transcendental, they do not merely adjust a curriculum, they amputate the soul of an entire civilization. The university was once a sanctuary of wisdom, ordered toward truth, and now it becomes a machine for producing technocrats, activists, skeptics, and haters, not saints and scholars or sages. In severing the intellect from its highest object, God, education collapses into a kind of fragmentation. So relativism becomes the rule of the day. Utilitarianism becomes the definition of the human person. Students are taught how to do many things, but rarely why they should do it, how they should do it, and definitely for whom they should do it. Ethics becomes optional. Beauty becomes subjective. Meaning becomes elusive. The result is cultural disintegration. Families and marriages are fracturing. Truth is nothing but a matter of opinion. Society loses any shared moral grammar. Alexander Solzhenitsyn warned us of this in his Harvard address. Men have forgotten God, and that's why all this has happened. Universities and abandoning metaphysics have not made the world more rational. They've made it more irrational, more cynical, and actually, frankly, more suicidal. The rise of depression, confusion, and identity collapse among students not as an anomaly, but as a logical consequence of education stripped of transcendence. A culture that trains minds, but not souls, produces brilliant barbarians, minds with no moral compass and hearts with no heavenly hope. Nowhere is this more evident than in the American public university system. Once noble in its aspirations, it's now become a coliseum of ideologies, a place where students are indoctrinated rather than educated. The National Catholic Register notes in that piece with George Weigel, A Catholic Fix for American Higher Education, colleges today saddle students with debt, give them little clarity on what it means to be human, and produces polarized graduates. Catholic parents are right to be deeply concerned about sending their children into public universities that, under the guise of academic freedom and progress, often become crucibles of secular indoctrination designed to dismantle every vestige of faith and virtue and identity that parents have painstakingly cultivated over 18 years at home, and saddling these parents and students with debt as a result. In far too many institutions, the classroom is not a neutral space for inquiry, it's a battleground. Faith is mocked. Moral absolutes are scorned. The church is caricatured as archaic and oppressive. Courses in philosophy, gender theory, literature, even the sciences, are increasingly shaped by ideologies that directly contradict Catholic anthropology, natural law, revealed truth, and worse still, the cultural environment of universities, fueled by moral relativism, hypersexuality, a celebration of radical autonomy, all of these undermine the conscience formation and covenantal worldview that faithful parents labored to instill in their children before they went off to college. So to send a child into such an environment unprepared is not merely risky, it is in many cases tantamount to permitting the spiritual sabotage that will happen. Paul warned us, do not be conformed to this world. Modern universities excel precisely today at conforming young souls to the spirit of the age rather than the mind of Christ, and I will stand by that. The rise of DEI bureaucracy, cancel culture, anti-human anthropology in curricula, that's no accident. It's the logical outcome of abandoning the metaphysical, the theological, the moral foundations of education. C.S. Lewis warned us, we make men with our chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. The chest is the imagery. It's where heart and reason meet. It's precisely what Catholic education cultivates through its sacramental, covenantal anthropology. You remove that, and you reduce man to a machine, a will to power, so to speak, a consumer, or worse, a god in his own eyes. The modern university now mirrors a kind of babble, a confusion of tongues with no common moral grammar. It teaches facts without wisdom, empowerment without virtue, identity without essence, and rights without responsibility. This is not merely bad pedagogy, friends. It is spiritual malformation. And the antidote to this malaise is not better funding or even curriculum reform. It's a total recalibration of purpose. Education must be reclaimed as a covenantal act, an ordered relationship between God and us, his children, his image bearers, one that forms the intellect to seek the truth and the will to choose the good. The Catholic covenantal framework and worldview provides us precisely this. It grounds the dignity of the human person as being bearers of the image of God, not a construct of race or class or gender or ideology. A being with a rational soul that has eternal consequence. Second, it restores theology to its rightful place as the integrating principle of all learning. Third, it binds education to virtue, linking truth to love and knowledge to moral responsibility. Augustine saw this clearly. Let knowledge be used as a kind of scaffolding, where we remove once the edifice of love is which we remove once the edifice of love is complete. In other words, education is not an end in itself. It is a means to charity, caritas, in veritate, in truth, love and charity in truth. This isn't nostalgic fantasy. It is incarnated in institutions like Ave Maria University, the University of Navarra, Franciscan University of Steubenville, Christendom College, Thomas Aquinas College, and forgive me if I don't mention a lot of the others. This is the pulse behind the Catholic classical education movement that's now sweeping America. It's what John Paul II called for in Excordia Ecclesiae. He wrote this, "A Catholic university's privileged task is to unite existentially by intellectual effort two orders of reality that too often tend to be placed in opposition, searching for truth and the certainty of knowing the fount of truth, who is God." Families, we must lead this charge. The only way to restore unity to human knowledge is to recover its lost center, God. And so, my friends, discern carefully how we think about sending our children to universities, and let's raise them to live lives for the glory of God. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.